Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, The House of the Dragon has premiered. The Invitation hits theaters, and director Jessica Thompson joins the show to discuss. Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 227 of Real Blend, a podcast that already lost its fantasy football season. Yeah. Imagine that. Imagine that. On this week's show, House of the Dragons has premiered, and we're going to go back to Westeros to discuss the return of Game of Thrones. The Invitation is hitting theaters this weekend, and because of that, we have director Jessica Thompson joining the show to discuss. Hello, Blenders. I'm Sean O'Connell, the managing editor here at Cinema Blend, and joined, as always, by Jake Hamilton, a Fox 32 in Chicago, who's a little under the weather. Hi, Jakey. How are you?
Hey, buddy. I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. You sound fine. I thought you were going to sound rough.
No, I mean, it's just it's all throat and head stuff, and it's not COVID. I've taken at this point literally 5 different tests, so I'm not riddled with COVID or anything. I just feel terrible.
And had. What do you mean? Yeah, you just have an actual like a sore throat. Like,
yeah, sore throat and headache and. I know that's the thing. We forget that people do have the capacity to get sick outside of COVID. Not feeling great, but I'm in it. And though I got to say, whatever horrible throat ripping soreness I'm feeling or the axe splitting my head does not compare to the betrayal that I felt of you leaving my fantasy football league this year.
Yeah, I can't tell you how much of a relief it is to not care about fantasy football. Maybe I'm just going to take a season off. Like, I do kind of enjoy playing it, but the last year I was in 2 leagues. One of them was with you and your friends. Mm-hmm. And I realized that it ruins the joy of like watching a football game.
See, that's so interesting because I feel the opposite. It makes me care about games that I otherwise wouldn't care about.
Oh, it's the only way I'll watch the Chicago Bears and care. You know, I'll have one guy on the.
You're the only one that watches the Chicago Bears and cares.
Gabe Kovach, the producer, sitting in for Kevin. But here's what I'm saying, though. On a Sunday night, I'll end up staying up late to cheer on a tight end that I don't care about.
That's great. That's fun.
See, I think that's fantastic.
No, because then if it doesn't go my way, I'm mad. And then I'm mad because of someone on the Cardinals. And it's just stupid.
Like, that's so interesting. Okay.
So I just need a break.
You're missed.
Well, thank you for it. I wish you luck. Good luck to your team. And good luck to Gabe. I'm sure you're playing as well, too, right?
I haven't drafted yet, but I imagine
neither have we.
Yeah.
Oh, and the draft is a whole thing too. Yeah, just no.
Okay, I'm gonna. You don't want to play fantasy football.
Jesus. Like, and then they gotta play football.
No one's forcing you to do
thing. It's like games. Everything. All right. I hope you guys are watching us on YouTube, where you get a visual element to the show. If you haven't yet watched us on YouTube, go to youtube.com/realblendpodcast. Give us a like and a subscribe. We're always trying to grow the army over that way. And from people who tune in on Friday mornings when that show drops. And then additionally, on Mondays, if you guys want extra Real Blend, sign up for Real Blend Premium, which gives you an ad-free version of the show, a newsletter. I'm writing a newsletter this week. And then, of course, the new shows that drop on Mondays. And this week is going to be a mailbag, I'm pretty sure. Is that
mailbag.
Right,
Ken? Mail time.
Mailbag.
Is that trademark?
Answering questions.
Mail time?
Yeah. Sure, you can say that. Why not?
It's time for mail. That's surely that'll clear. It's time for mail.
Yeah,
that'll clear.
That's all good. Well, Jake's got a song that goes with it. So
I got a song for everything.
Musical rights as well cleared for that.
Yeah. Gabe is gonna love the fact that I'm like sucking on cough drops the entire time while recording this.
Yeah.
That's so great for the audio.
No, it sounds good. It sounds really good. No difference. It's like some ASMR type thing going on there. Whatever you're up to.
Maybe that'll grow the audience even more. I don't know.
This is
all of a sudden our ratings skyrocket for this episode.
This has been an unusual time for horror. We had a pretty good summer in terms of Black Phone and Nope. Jake has been talking about Barbarian, which is going to be coming, I believe, next week. Prey, obviously, was on.
I think it's 2 weeks. Barbarian, I think it's 2 weeks from now.
Barbarian is 2 weeks from now. Okay.
I believe so, yeah.
I can't wait for us to talk about that.
We'll figure out how we're going to talk about it. It's going to be a difficult one. And then this week, Sony has a movie called The Invitation, which is coming to theaters. And we got a chance to sit down with director Jessica Thompson to talk about her approach to the film. So let's throw right to it. This is Jessica Thompson joining the Real Blend podcast to talk about her new horror film, The Invitation.
one of the things I really like the most about the script for The Invitation is that early on, it brings up all of the red flag issues that we would have with the premise while we're watching it, where we're like, you can't go on that trip, or the minute you get there, like, text your friend kind of thing. And it tackles those things head on. So what were the conversations like about addressing those very real issues of like catfishing in 2022?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that Evie is, you know, someone who's looking for connection. She's a lonely person living in New York. She's just lost her mom. She has no family left. And then she finds out through a DNA test that she has this long lost cousin. And I think so, therefore, it's making that character believable, right? Like, it's making that, you know, this person that's really craving human connection and that she really wants to go on this journey. Also, someone who's like stuck in a rut, can't pay her bills, is allured by this, you know, this newfound relative who can pay her way. And, you know, to be honest, I'm someone who has gone on a fifth date in Paris when and flew all the way over there. I'm someone who's like a sucker for romance. And it's like, you know, who doesn't want to go on this trip of a lifetime?
Hold on, we have to unpack that a little bit. At what point in the middle of this process did you think to yourself, maybe this isn't a great idea?
No, absolutely. I'm still with the guy. We're married.
Hey, there you go.
So, yeah, we met in New York, and then we decided to fly to Paris. So, I mean, isn't that what people want? People want love. People want romance, right?
Okay, so that's why there's a strong romantic current going through this horror film.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I love all kinds of films. I am genre agnostic.
Well, I want to go into that because I was curious if horror was a genre that you wanted to sort of specialize in, or if this was a one-off project that you just were interested in the concept.
No, absolutely. I'll definitely come back to horror, but there's so many other genres that I want to explore, sci-fi, thriller, you know, definitely horror is something that I grew up on. To me, it's like a roller coaster. I was always addicted to the adrenaline high of knowing that the scare is going to come and then, you know, not wanting to look away, but wanting to look away. Yeah, I grew up watching, you know, Jaws and The Birds and, you know, Alien and, you know, The Shining. These are all like my favorite horror films, The Omen. And I've always wanted to make a film in this genre. And when I read Blair's script, when it came to me, I thought, you know, what a unique way into an old kind of world, you know, vampires, you know, that's definitely been done. But I felt this kind of origin story of a Bride of Dracula had really not been done. Right. And it felt really fresh and modern. Yeah.
Well, to that end, I want to talk about your use of sound design because and I had to unfortunately watch it on a laptop, you know, but I can't wait to go into a theater because I can tell the way that you play with your mix is to keep your audience off balance. So if you can, maybe just talk a little bit about the approach you had to that.
Yeah, I mean, sound design is one of my favorite parts of the process. It really is. We found a really unique blend, and I won't give away what it is, but like that to create the sound of the vampires. You know, I didn't want it to sound like anything else we'd heard before. And I wanted it to sound organic, though. I wanted it to sound like it was an animalistic sound, not like an alien sound or something like that, something that came from this world, but something just a little bit off about it. And I really love as well, working with my composer, Dara, we really got to create this sumptuous soundtrack. And I was really drawn to kind of siren songs. And so we had three women sing a lot of the kind of orchestral moments in the film. Oh, wow. And that kind of, you know, feeds into the three brides of Dracula. You know, so there's a lot of little things like that, but something that I feel really works in, especially in a cinema, is that panning effect that you get when you get, you know, that beautiful Atmos, you know, Dolby Atmos. And it's like, you never know which direction the creature's coming. And that definitely adds to the horror, right? So yeah, that's some of my favorite parts. And being on these old lots at Sony that, you know, so many big directors, Martin Scorsese and, you know, have mixed their sound on the same stages that I got to mix. And it was just such a joy. Yeah.
You kick your movie off with a pretty disturbing death. I won't go into detail about it. I'll let people discover it for themselves. But I want you to talk a bit about your approach to showing deaths on screen. You do, you know, leave a lot to taking from Jaws. You know, it's more scary what you don't see almost. And I'm just curious if that's a conscious choice that you made in terms of how you...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And don't get me wrong. I love a little bit of gore every now and then. But it's like, to me, it's always, as soon as you show your monster, this is something that I, as even though Guillermo del Toro is one of my favorite filmmakers of all time, he shows these monsters quite quickly. And that's because he's usually trying to have us empathize with the monster, right? But I think as you, soon as you show your monster, then they stop being as scary. So to me, it's all about, you know, leaving that off screen, leaving it to our imagination. Often what we're imagining is worse than what we can show.
Sure.
It's definitely a conscious decision. And I also think, you know, I wanted to make an elevated, sophisticated horror film. I didn't want to just, you know, slashers are not really my thing. You know, and I think, and for some reason, those films don't scare me. Like it's genuinely when I care about the characters and I care about their relationships, that's when I get terrified.
Yeah. To that end, I think that you, the way with your pacing, you spend far more time on characterization, you know, and building up the relationships between the characters, to the point where, you know, almost an hour in, I'm like, isn't this a vampire movie? Like you definitely are sustaining the tension so that you can get to your reveals later on. And I assume that was that all built into the script, or is that something that you worked on as you were putting
it? Yeah, I mean, both. It was something that I added to once the script came, you know, that I added to. I was like, if we don't believe that they've actually fallen in love, then we don't care. That's something that I truly believe. The Shining is one of my favorite horror films. And the reason why is we build up that family. We build up that family unit so that when Jack turns on his family, you know, that we believe it, that we're scared for them, that we also don't know whether to believe that. Is he truly evil? Is there any hope left? Can we turn him back? What's going on? You know, and I think you've got to spend the legwork, you know, building up that tension, building up that authenticity. And, you know, some people might find it, you know, a little bit too long. I find it just right because this, you know, I made a horror film that I want to watch. And to me, it's like, this is how it often works. You know, when you get these real life horror stories, it's quite often not the monster under the bed, but the monster in the bed, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And you have such compelling characters around Nat, you know, that we're always kind of second guessing their motivations and trying to figure out what direction that the story may go in.
Fell out of my head.
To that end, I want to bring up, I believe the main butler, is he played by Sean Pertwee?
Yes, absolutely. My favorite actors.
Can you talk about his voice? His voice is outstanding.
I literally could have this man read anything to me. He could read the dictionary to me. Like, it is just the most incredible voice, and he has such control of it. He is just a delight to work with, an incredibly, incredible professional. He's been, you know, he's like a multi-generation actor. You know, his dad was an actor, and I think even his granddad was an actor. And it really shows in like everything he does. But that voice, I know. I'm just like, could you just read the? I just would sometimes randomly ask him to read things for me.
Yeah, there are reasons why Nat sort of distrusts him early in the movie. And I don't want to sort of give those away. But like the way that he speaks, I was like, yeah, I could see that. It's something menacing about him.
I definitely wanted to paint him as a villain. I mean, and he is for sure. But he's such an interesting, yeah. As soon as I was casting this role, I knew Sean was the right person to play it. And I'm so glad he agreed.
So you mentioned The Shining a bunch, and obviously The Overlook is a character in that movie. You have a mansion that's very much a character in your movie. And I was kind of stunned. Do you use models? Is there model use at all in it when you're showing exteriors? Is that an actual place?
No, though. But I really love using miniatures, but I did not use them in this film. So it's a real place. So what happened is that we did build the sets. So we built some of the interiors, but we actually shot inside the solarium scene, the rehearsal dinner scene inside the dining hall. Those are the music room. Those are all real sets. Real location. And then we built like the grand hall and Evie's bedroom and things like that we were in and needed a bit more space and a bit more maneuverability. But this castle is a real medieval castle in Hungary. And when I walked up to it, I knew immediately it was the castle. We'd gone on all these backstage tours of all these incredible castles in Hungary. It was so fun to, you know, I'm an ancient history buff, and it was just wild to be able to go, you know, into some of these castles that people and see parts of it that people hadn't been in for, you know, decades. And this was in the Tudor style, which was right for our world, considering that the story is set in England. But also, once I found out that Madame Bathory's great great grandson actually built that castle, it's called Narosladdan Castle. I knew. So for those who don't know, Madame Bathory is called the Blood Countess. She is arguably the first female serial killer, and she killed 600 virgins and bathed in their blood. And that was her great-great-grandson's castle. And there's a portrait of her in the castle, and it's so creepy. And I was like, oh, we have to film here. Like, this is a given.
I want you to sort of expand on the ability to sort of step into this existing history, you know, to find these locations that actually do exist. Because what I think is an important selling point of this movie is that you do feel like you're walking into sort of a Victorian horror film. So maybe talk about like concerns you might have had of being able to build the sets that really bring to life what's on the page, but then finding these castles, you know, that you can really use as locations.
I mean, because there's really two stories going on, right? There's the romance and then there's the horror. There's the kind of fairy tale and then there's like the thing that's boiling underneath. So you needed a place that really sold both, that really on one hand felt charming and beautiful and alluring, and then on the other hand, you know, kind of was macabre and disturbing. And so finding that in the architecture is really important. But I really worked closely with Felicity Abbott, our production designer, and created a lot of the kind of textures that you see on the flooring, on the ceilings, on the walls, that really kind of pull you into that environment. But yeah, it is. There is something to be said for like filming in an actual old place. Also, living in Budapest for 6 months, Vlad the Impaler is who the original Dracula was based upon, or arguably that's what a lot of people believe. And he was actually held in prison under the Buda Castle in Budapest for 13 years. And going to those tunnels and being there, knowing that man, you know, hundreds and hundreds of years ago was there, this horrible human who, you know, impaled all of these people. It's just, there's something, you know, magical about that. And that's the beauty of filmmaking, is that you get to explore these worlds.
Imagine if you had to set up in Vancouver and try to capture that mood.
I know, there was a thought at one point, because obviously I'm Australian, of filming it in Australia. I was like, we don't have castles. It's not, you know.
I want to talk about the evolution of Evie's costumes, because I think that they speak a lot about her character development. Early on, she... they're listening
to it. It's okay. It's fine. No, a light went off, but it's fine.
Early on, she sports this killer Outlander t-shirt, which I found to be a really funny nod. But then she goes through this series of dresses that I think really sort of reveal the progress of her character. Can you talk about some of the choices made with that? And maybe start with that Outlander t-shirt, because I think
that's really deliberate. That you noticed the Outlander t-shirt. I was wondering here how many people will notice it. I mean, that to me is as well. I was someone who, over the pandemic, I'm sure a lot of people did, binged Outlander. I mean, it was it's just one of those shows that like draws you in. And it's like not even my style of show, but for some reason I was just enthralled by it. And so I wanted to like establish that she's a woman who kind of gets taken away. You know, she's kind of someone who loves those romance stories. And, you know, I think a lot of us are like that. But and then the evolution, like you said, of what he is dressing her in versus her choice of costume. You know, she's got quite an eclectic artistic taste. And then he starts to dress her in these beautiful gowns. And the gowns, Danielle Knox, our costumer, was just, you know, she did, these were all bespoke. You know, we designed these all from scratch. And in particular, the rehearsal dinner dress that she's in, that red, those red feathers, I wanted to her to look like prey, you know, and that's why we chose feathers, because if you notice, there's a lot of you know, dead things on the walls, like dead, you know, deer and goats and things like that. We've got taxidermy all over the house. So I was playing into that theme of like the prey and the predator and the hunter and the hunted. So I really, you know, in the rehearsal dinner scene where the plot really twists, I wanted her to look, on one hand, this beautiful, you know, stunning ball gown, but on the other hand, she looks like prey. She, you know, and that's definitely something we were playing with in the costumes. And in her wedding dress, I wanted to do a traditional Romanian, you know, because that's where Dracula is from. So I wanted to do a traditional Romanian outfit, but then modernize it. And so that's why it's got the backless back, but it's got the traditional, that's all traditional embroidery.
The veil is chilling. The veil itself is chilling. I'm not sure how a design can actually evoke that type of terror. But seeing
that transition going into the wedding, I had in my mind from day one of going through the veil and kind of shooting through the veil. That's something that I just, you know, hadn't really seen, and I thought could be really eerie and creepy. And I think it succeeds.
You brought the pandemic. You didn't film at all during the. Did you have to film during the pandemic?
We filmed, I mean, arguably it's still going on. So, sure. You know, we did film at the end of 2021. We got pushed back because of the pandemic. So it was actually, we did shut down twice though, you know, luckily only for 2 days each time. So it was definitely, you know, not as hard as some other productions. It definitely came with its challenges. And I'm very much over wearing masks on set because it makes it so hard, you know, to emote and to like communicate with your actors and your crew. So I will look forward to the day when we don't have to do that. But of course, you know, better to be safe. So.
Yeah, I do love speaking to filmmakers to figure out like what kind of challenges they don't anticipate, you know, when those situations come up. And masks, I'm sure, are definitely one of them.
Yeah, and one of our, I mean, I don't think you'll be able to tell which character, but one of our smaller supporting roles ended up getting COVID. We had to wait to film her. We had to film her on a green screen. And, you know, so at the last minute, we suddenly have to like, you know, do all of that and kind of make sure it's technically the right way and shooting it with stamp body doubles and like things like that. And obviously it just adds more to your days. It adds, you know, it makes budgets a little bit tighter. It'd be lovely to one day not have to use $1 million towards COVID and get to use it towards the screen, right? What's on the screen.
Absolutely. I want to talk about Thomas and just the ability for him to walk this very difficult line between having to be likable, but yet, you know, have us sort of keep a side eye on them. Can you talk about the conversations you had in terms of prepping that balance?
Yeah. And I really told him, you know, that was something that we really worked on in rehearsals, which is our, you know, really our time together to, you know, really hone this character. And I mean, first of all, I was impressed with him, wildly impressed with him. He auditioned for the role and he blew me out of the water. It was really like, it was his role to play. And I said to him, you know, obviously you're playing layers, you know, you're playing your version of what you think she wants. And then when she, and then you're adapting to when she, you know, because your ultimate aim is to win this woman over. So then you're adapting to what you, what she needs you to be. And then, but also deep down, you're, you know, this evil, malicious person. So, you know, there's multiple layers. And like you said, he's got to be charming. He's got to win the audience over. And so sometimes I would actually get him to do, he's someone who loves to play and loves to do different takes in different ways. And so sometimes if I even wasn't sure, you know, or I wanted to get it in done in multiple ways, we wouldn't just like deliver the same take over and over. Sometimes I'd ask him to, you know, put on a little bit more charm or like, you know, give a nod to the undercurrents of his character. And then that's the beauty of the edit room and why the editor is the third storyteller, because that's when you also get to craft your characters. Thomas and Natalie, you know, to a lesser extent, because her character is a little bit more, you know, solid throughout. Mm-hmm. Thomas, definitely we got to play a lot. And particularly in that library scene at the very end, we played a lot with it, kind of going really loud and really soft and just, you know, using his voice and his command of the space. It was really great.
And then how much fun was it choreographing? Because eventually you get into some fight sequences and it's a deviation from what we've been experiencing up until this point. So how much fun was it to sort of plunge into that and test the physicality of your actors?
Yeah, absolutely. And I, you know, like I said, I'm someone who loves all genre, loves, you know, I'm genre agnostic, except don't see myself ever doing a straight comedy, though I would argue there's even comedy in this film. But, you know, I love action, and I love action that's unique to a character. So for instance, you know, we all will quote The Matrix and how much that style is unique to that world. And so I really worked with the stunt team to figure out a style of fighting that was unique to these vampires, to these particular vampires. And that was really fun to kind of come up with that, the use of their claws, the use of, you know, things like that, and using the claws as weapons as opposed to just like nails or something like that. That was really fun. And like all of my actors are incredibly talented in that regard. And they all were willing, even Alana, who hadn't done stunts before, everyone gave it their absolute all. And it's so fun. You know, who doesn't want to wake up every day and just get to like, you know, do these incredible kung fu moves? And it was fun to film. I hadn't filmed action like that. And I'm someone who's meticulous about what I do. And so I went and researched some of my favorite, you know, action films, a lot of, the master, the grandmaster, Wong Kar-wai, and like, you know, a lot of kung fu movies that I love, and really studied them to see how they create this tension in the action, and also to still have character be at the forefront, you know, that they all have their own unique fighting style depending on whether they're, you know, new to this world, like Evie, Lucy, who's younger and arguably a little bit softer, Victoria, who's more vicious. Like, how do we play with their characters within their physicality?
Yeah, it's very true, because what I was going to say is, like, there have been examples of vampires on screen over the years and the way that they display their powers. And you almost want to find a fresh way into that, which I feel that you did, you know, and sort of.
But also keep it grounded, right? Not just keep it like, I didn't want it to be like supernatural and superhuman to the extent that it's unbelievable. I really wanted it to still be physical fighting so that we feel every scratch and every punch.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's been a lot of talk lately about the sort of 45-day window, you know, to go out of theaters and get onto a streaming service. Sony obviously has been super supportive in terms of keeping movies in theaters. And you see movies like Black Phone and obviously Nope doing really well at the box office this summer. So how important was it to have the invitation be in theaters, especially for sort of the communal aspect of a horror movie?
I mean, yeah, that's the joy of making a film, right? It's that communal aspect. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, the streamers definitely have their role to play. And it's incredible that we have now more stories being told because of it. But really, this is a cinematic experience. And I go to the cinema to laugh and cry and get scared with my fellow community. And, you know, I just saw Nope recently, and it was so fun to do that in like such a communal setting. And I think that this is the best way for this film to be enjoyed. Like you said, the sound design, the visual spectacle of it, you know, that's best enjoyed in the theater. And Sony has been an incredible partner. They gave us this release date before we'd finished shooting, which is a very, you know, which is a great testament, you know, to me and the crew. And that, you know, it was something that I'm very proud about, you know, to have your film wide released around the world, to be opening up in my hometown in Sydney, Australia on the same day that I'm opening up in America. You know, that's just what a joy. That's what filmmakers live for.
What will you do opening weekend?
I mean, Sony's going to put on a little party, but I think I'm going to fly my mom out from Australia and just, you know, revel in the fact that I made a studio film and that I'm proud of it and that I think the film is sensational. And yeah, and then maybe try not to look at reviews that are good. Look at the good reviews.
Jessica, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean. Thanks so much.
All right, talk soon. We want to thank Jessica Thompson for coming by the show and talking about her new film, The Invitation, which we're going to be discussing later on in the show in great detail. And thank you to our friends at Sony for hooking that interview up. So a review is forthcoming. Before we get into the meat of the show, well, I guess this is the meat of the show. We want to talk about the House of the Dragon premiere, which had good numbers numbers. HBO Max. Yeah, fantastic, to show that the interest in the Game of Thrones franchise and Westeros is still pretty strong, despite the fact that, you know, people like to kick around the final season of Game of Thrones, which I think is unfair. I mean, I really do think that there's good things in the final season of Game of Thrones. As a culmination to where it was going, I think it was perfectly satisfying. And so, but getting into this new show. So the first episode was on Sunday. I don't know how many episodes are in the season. Do you?
I looked it up. It's, according to Google, it's 10, whether or not that's, I mean, but a majority of the Game of Thrones seasons, particularly the early ones, were 10.
Okay, got it.
I think that's HBO's usual order.
Yeah. What I'm curious about, though, is I don't know if you remember with Game of Thrones, usually 9 was the big one, then 10 was always kind of like the epilogue and the setup for the next season. So I'm curious if they're going to have that same sort of structure.
Well, and I guess I'll say up front that we're not going to really get into spoilers here.
How many have you seen?
Just the one.
Same.
They gave us access to it for the junket, and they only gave us access to the first one. Well, I didn't do it, but I still got the link to watch it.
So. I didn't get the junket.
But if you don't want to know anything about House of the Dragon,
owner of the dog Daenerys didn't get the Game of Thrones junket.
I don't know.
I'm surprised you didn't guilt your way into
it. Here's it. I really thought that was going to like help my case. And this is how naive I am about this industry. When contacting HBO about the junket, I sent them a picture of Daenerys and I was like, this is my dog and her name's Daenerys. And I really thought that was going to help. It did not at all.
Well, as you found out, the opening card, they were like, we actually never want to talk about Daenerys.
Nothing to do with Daenerys.
We don't want to talk about Daenerys.
That was really funny in that opening card. For people who might not have seen it, they basically lay out the timeline in a opening credits sort of deal and make it very, very clear that this place takes place 172 years before Daenerys comes around.
They basically had like a neon arrow pointing like not about Daenerys.
But
there are a lot of moments when you're watching this initial episode where, you know, because it is Westeros and it's is it King's Landing? Is that King's Landing the area? Like there are a lot of familiar locations and places the characters are walking through that you're reminded that, oh, OK, there's a rich history to this show. And I had no problems. It was really funny. You were telling me in text, Jake, that you were trying to like make connections to the existing characters or the families that have been introduced already to this. I didn't have that problem at all. Like right off the bat, I was able
like
to
you didn't
just
have
sort
that problem or you just didn't care.
It's not that I didn't care. I think I just accepted the fact that this takes place so far ahead that I was just okay to get into whatever the, because they established right off the bat that there's a king who has been put into place and we're a couple of years into his run. Paddy Considine, who I didn't recognize. I can't, like, I spent the entire episode being like, who is that? Who is that? And then saw his name in the credits and I was like, oh, that's great. But I fell into it right away. I, you know, in, and I got invested into it in the way that I was into Game of Thrones, in that I'm already trying to figure out the political, you know, machinations of who's going to be manipulating who. And I thought that it got off to a really great start. I also thought maybe they were kind of responding to the everything looks too dark in a few of our episodes, because this is like sun-drenched dragons flying through the sky, like right off the bat. And I thought all the money, it's interesting because I had just watched the Lord of the Rings episodes on Amazon, and we'll talk about those when we're able to. And while these are similar, I thought that House of the Dragon showed its budget more, if it has although I think that's interesting, the Lord of the Rings has a pretty high budget. They just look different, and House of the Dragon looks a little bit more authentic, if that makes sense. I thought it looked fantastic, and I thought the story was
well. I feel like Westeros is always, because especially since they shoot all around Europe, like Westeros looks like a very tangible, real world, as opposed to the world of Middle Earth tends to, short of like the New Zealand vast vistas that they shot in, a lot of aspects of Middle Earth tend to need to be CGI in a way. But Westeros has always, to me, felt very sort of lived in and felt like I, you know, like you could walk around, you know, Malta at any point and like turn a corner and you're at a place where they shot Game of Thrones or Milan or whatever the case may be.
Very true. But I also was reminded pretty early on in the episode that like, oh yeah, this is really violent. Game of Thrones is a really violent series, because this one gets, and especially it's a lot of it through Matt Smith, who seems to be like, he's going to be a really fascinating character. And I'm intrigued to see where they go with this. Did you also enjoy the first step into this world?
Yeah, I really liked it. It felt in both a good and a bad way, I would say, very familiar. There was very much like going back into King's Landing, an element of like, oh, that's like, welcome back, we're here. Like it felt really cool. Even I think there was a beautiful sweeping shot over King's Landing. And there was a moment where I was like, oh, like we're back in this place.
But did you think like, oh, this is all going to get burned to the ground one day?
Oh, I did.
Because that went through my mind.
So there is an element of, and in the same way, it's kind of how I felt going into like the Star Wars prequels, where it's like, it is kind of a bummer that like we know what's going to happen. Like we don't know. So I guess the big mystery is more so how and not like what. Because we're so far out, like 172 years, a lot of stuff has to happen before we get to the events of game. I mean, the fact that they're already worried about the White Walkers, I thought was interesting, even though it doesn't happen for another 172 years. There are some aspects of the story that felt familiar in that I just hope that we don't, like, the king feels a bit on the weaker side, like a little bit of a Robert Baratheon. There are just a lot of elements where it's like, okay, I hope we don't go down those paths again. Like we've been, like the story needs to be shaken up a little bit, and it can't just be a story of Succession, because we literally already have an HBO show called Succession that does that very well. So I'm super into it. I thought it did a great job. And granted, it's just the pilot, you know, like most shows do not have themselves figured out by the time we do the pilot. So I'm super into it. I think it looks great, feels great, sounds great. The score is always just when it comes to the Game of Thrones series. I think all the casting is fantastic, but it's very much a like, okay, we're back in, feels good, sounds good, feels familiar, but you got to give me something I've never seen before, because as of now, this just feels like Game of Thrones.
Yeah, I can see that. Didn't we read something recently that they at least have an idea of what the ending of this is? Did you read that?
I mean, it wouldn't surprise. I mean, I feel like they have to, right? And George R. R. Martin has been, I think they learned their lesson in that regard, has been very involved with this. Depending on how long they want to stretch this out, a buddy of mine was like, I think this is only going to be like one or two seasons. I was like, no, that makes no, like HBO needs another Game of Thrones. Like they're not bringing all of this back for one or two seasons. Like they're looking to get many years out of this. And I think that's why they set it so far back.
They do have other spinoffs though, right?
So yeah, maybe, well, they're doing the Jon Snow prequel series, which in cool, a way is interesting, because like if you start think of it in terms of like a television trilogy, Game of Thrones is like the middle chapter in a weird way.
The Jon Snow stuff is a sequel though, right?
It's a sequel. Yeah, it's a sequel to what happened in Game of Thrones.
Okay, that's what I thought.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
I'd be curious to see where this ends up going. Funny enough, you were talking about the Rings of Power. The showrunners of Rings of Power told me that they already know what the final shot of the show is going to be.
That's interesting.
Which in my mind, it has to be. Of course, they wouldn't tell me what it was. But like, don't you think the last shot of Rings of Power has to be Bilbo's hand going into Smeagol's hand going into the water and grabbing the ring? And then that would be like the last shot.
That would make sense.
And then just have it sort of bridge into. But
it kind of reminds me of, and I actually am a big defender of this movie. I love Red Dragon. The Silence of the Lambs prequel. And do you remember that like it ends with Lecter being back in the cell and that really mean warden being like there's a young woman here from the FBI who wants to see you. And then Lecter's like, what's her name? And it cuts to black. I always love that. I thought that was great.
Pretty cool.
I think that'd be kind of cool if they did something like that.
Rings of Power is next week, right?
September 2nd.
September 2nd.
First two episodes.
First two episodes.
They're going to drop the first two. Which are going to be available to see on the big screen on August 31st. Cinemark's going to play them on the big screen, and Sean, you've seen them. Whenever I was watching them on my TV, my thought went to like, damn, I wish I could see this on the big screen. To me, it feels like a big screen show.
It really does.
I'm curious to see how that and this, how Game of Thrones and a Lord of the Rings series kind of going head to head. With their seasons happening at the same, because they're premiering two episodes, so it's almost like they premiered this week. Like whatever, I don't know how many episodes Lord of the Rings is, but their seasons are going to be exactly that far along as they're going.
Oh, I think you're right. I think let me see if Rings is eight and they're dropping the first two on week one. Does that mean that their finales are going to be
no? Because if they're dropping the first two on week one, it means that each series is going to have two episodes out next weekend.
Exactly. So wouldn't that mean that? Oh, okay.
But it's only eight episodes.
Yeah, it's only. You're right. Okay. So if it were 10, then it would be.
I don't think we can talk in depth at all about Lord of the Rings because I think there are embargoes, and I'm not quite sure when they are.
We'll talk about it next week, so we don't need to. Yeah.
Because Kevin's seen it as well. I think.
I'd like to say that they are very different.
No, 100%. But it's an embarrassment of riches for fantasy fans right now.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Between Sandman, which I know Gabe wants to talk about, between Sandman and Rings of Power and House of the Dragon, in terms of the world of fantasy and like high caliber television, we are still very much, I think, within the age of what do they call it? The golden age of TV.
But it's also, I thought this too while watching both House of the Dragon and the Rings of Power, like the line that used to separate television and movies in terms of like budget and scope is now, I know we've been saying like it's gone for a while, but it's completely gone.
Oh, it's done.
Game of Thrones was kind of really put the nail in the coffin of that, right? Yeah. I feel like once we got the Battle of the Bastards, whatever one had the big battle that was looks like a Lord of the Rings. People, I think, pulled Lord of the Rings out of the...
Yeah.
Another reason why I kind of was like, oh, this would be so cool on the big screen. So I am kind of thrilled that like... That cool. And that's interesting too, that some of the movie theaters are at least bending their previous rigidity about not putting anything streaming into theaters. I know that Cinemark and it's not like a Regal AMC situation, but still, if there's one near you and you have the opportunity to and you feel safe enough doing it, you have the chance to go see new Tolkien in the theater, which is pretty exciting. Gabe, you want to talk about The Sandman, which I don't even know, is it on Netflix?
It's on Netflix. So I have not seen The House of the Dragon yet. We're recording this on Tuesday because I spent my weekend binging The Sandman. I saw some of our listeners reaching out asking us to discuss. So I'm not going to...
How's Thomas Hayden Church? Is it good?
He's great. He's great. It was they repurposed every single one of his lines from the movie and then just put them into different context.
Awesome.
No, it's really cool. And I've been glad to see. I had not read the comic, although I've remembered after seeing it that someone gave me the first trade. So I'm finally picking that back up and reading it. But it's based on a Neil Gaiman comic book, very, very famous comic book. And I before I saw it,
one of only four graphic novels to ever make the New York Times bestseller list.
Fantastic. Oh, wow. That's cool.
Yeah. And I was enthused to see fans of the comic because I had never caught up with it. Liked the series as much as sort of like general audience seemed to. It seems to be doing really well. And I highly recommend it. I really enjoyed it. It was super bingeable. Like I said, I spent my weekend sort of chewing it over. And the pitch that I gave Jake, because he had seen the first episode and he just hadn't committed to going back to it, was how it's really okay with being very dark. It has like, and the Stephen King was the pull that I had when I referenced it for Jake, because it has that sort of tone. There's one episode 5, if you're familiar with the series. It's not, I don't want to give it the typical, you know, how Netflix series always has like, there's like the one episode that's completely separate, you know, this is sort of that episode for the Netflix series, but it is fantastic. And I think it earns its place in the series at large. But it's, you know, this one episode barely has the main characters in it. It has one guy that's sort of a piece of the story. Mm. And it's just this very King, Stephen King-esque, simple, like, felt like it could have been the script for somebody's own, like, feature film, like indie horror feature film about, you know, what if a guy who has the power to compel everyone around him to tell the truth and only the truth of how they're feeling in the moment. What if they walked into a diner in a small town and where everyone kind of knows each other, how would their dynamics change and how would that sort of situation build?
Is that the premise of one episode or the whole series?
That's one episode. Okay. That's what I'm saying. Like the series for me, it has this brilliant sort of ability. It's not an anthology and it's not a monster of the week, but within it, it has this really great cadence of sort of letting you drop into these singular stories that sort of progress the through line, but just builds the world out about like how colorful and dark and wild the world can be. The series itself is about follows this character called Morpheus or Dream or the Lord of Dreams, the King of Dream, King of the Dreaming. And it's a fantasy story that's basically set in our world, but it's what if sort of destiny, despair, death and dreams were personified as sort of gods. They're called the Endless. And the whole series, this whole first season, does a really good job of sort of trickling the mechanics of the world and the rules of the world out to you as you go, which I thought was really great. Like even like the last scene of the final episode, some of the dialogue reveals things that sort of still keeping you guessing about how the machinations of everything works, which is really exciting and has you excited for what's to come next. Cause you don't totally know how these gods interact and why they are the way they are. But the central story follows Dream, who basically, when we fall asleep, we go to his world, his realm, which is the dream world. And he sort of is in charge of our dreams, of creating dreams and nightmares and how that is affects humanity. And the series is sort of him rebuilding that after it's destroyed. And it's pretty awesome.
I'm ignorant on Neil Gaiman, who I know that people kind of love. Is this primarily what he's known for, or does he have other properties?
American Gods is pretty popular.
He's known for him too? I would say he's extremely prolific. I'm slowly sort of going through his work and I've been loving it. There's a lot that he's American Gods is one.
American Gods is honestly probably one of the top five novels I've ever read in my entire life. It's just a phenomenal book.
Yeah. And I would say this is up there as one of his more notable works and definitely more popular works that people know. But it's great. He's a great world builder and I think has a really interesting way that he approaches sort of character and story. It's fantasy, but it feels very grounded. And then it's just sort of like moments of whimsy that just kind of take you to another world. So it's cool.
All right. Well, before we move out of the what we're loving on streaming, I just want to mention that Michelle and I are late to The Staircase.
Sure.
But we started watching that. And Colin Firth is incredible. Is he up for awards? Did that time pass?
I think he and she were nominated.
Toni Collette?
Yes.
To me,
Toni Collette is the MVP of, I mean, what? Well, particularly because we get so many different variations of quote unquote the truth. But my God, that's without getting too much into it. Now, did you ever see the Netflix documentary that they talk about?
No. Okay, no, this is what we were curious about. So Michelle and I are through four episodes at this point right now. And for people who have no clue, the characters, the main characters over the course of this trial are being followed by a documentary crew.
Yeah.
And we're trying not to research too much because we really don't want to know where the show is going, which is weird because this whole, this took place in North Carolina, but it took place in Durham. So Durham's like,
I was wondering if you're familiar with that story.
I was familiar with the story only because it was in the headlines around here kind of thing. Gabe says that Toni Collette and Colin Firth were both nominated and absolutely needed to be. They were incredible. And this whole cast is loaded with incredible people like
Sophie Turner,
Michael Stuhlbarg. And
Michael Stuhlbarg might be one of the most underappreciated actors working today. Like just he's that man
amazing.
Is genuinely one of the best.
How great is Parker Posey? Oh my God.
I didn't even realize it's one of those things where like, you know, it's Parker Posey, but she's so completely different than she normally. Oh, she's phenomenal.
And then the girl who plays Priscilla Presley in the Baz Luhrmann movie.
Yes. Yep.
Is the other daughter who sort of defects. It's great. It's a really fascinating story. And I'm really curious to see where it's going to go.
Yeah.
Because
it goes in directions that you don't think it should go.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying. Like, we just finished episode four. There are eight total. And when we got to the end of four, there was like closure, a sort of closure. And Michelle would turn to me. She's like, is that it? Like, is that the end of it? And I was like, no, I think there's like another whole half of the story to go. So I'll be curious to see where it's going to go. I was wrong. Okay. So I thought that Michael Peterson, who Colin Firth plays, had a situation in one of his books that a character died by falling down the stairs. Is that not the case at all? Did I make that up completely?
I don't,
because he is a writer.
Yes, he is a writer. I don't remember that coming up.
I thought that was significant.
It's been a while since I saw the series.
Okay. Well, it's great. And if you have HBO Max, I would highly recommend.
Yeah, before they take it away.
If you like true
crime. No shit.
Stuff, right? Jeez, we better finish those four episodes before they just yank it up there.
You guys see that? Someone posted.
When are they going to change the name to HBO Minimum?
Oh. Someone posted that a shot of from Infinity War of everyone dusting, and they said that this is HBO Max right now, and it's all their titles just like disappearing.
Did you guys notice how that teaser that they released like yesterday or whatever? It felt very much timed around all this news about things dropping. They're like, we've got a ton of stuff still coming.
Yeah, but there are a lot of things in there that people thought were being canceled. Like Titans was still in there, and Doom Patrol was still in there. So
you know what I love is that. They're taking stuff off, but Tusk, Kevin Smith's Tusk, made it back on HBO Max somehow.
Hey, I like Tusk. And
it's filmed in Charlotte, North Carolina.
Kevin Smith just told me minutes ago that he's planning on doing a Tusk 2.
No, he's not.
Very good. And then I talked to Justin Long a few minutes later, and I was like, dude, Kevin Smith just told me you guys are doing Tusk 2. And he was like, what the hell? He just texted me that. I thought that was supposed to be a secret.
He's not. He's doing Mallrats 2,
and then we did the one of my favorite jokes. This is like Tusk with like the James Cameron. He goes, yeah, it's gonna be Tusk with an S, and then it's gonna be a dollar sign. It's gonna be Tusks with a dollar sign.
Beautiful. I think that's the greatest story in the world. What else would you call it?
A joke never gets old.
We'll see what happens. And we're gonna. Oh well, Clerks 3 is coming.
Stop, James. I'm gonna mute all of that. the complaints. I already see them in my inbox.
Clerks 3 is gonna be coming to theaters very, very soon, and we hope to maybe get Kevin Smith on the show. So I will. I'll tease that out without.
We were promising. In his home.
Yes.
You never know. He talked extensively about that.
It's not that he wouldn't want to.
My interview and Kevin's interview.
It's that you never know when things fall through.
And also, if you haven't heard, Kevin's bringing Clerks 3 around on a roadshow tour, and he announced a bunch of dates. And so if he's coming to a town near you, you should go see that.
Did he go to Charlotte already?
No, he's going to be coming. And it is a weekend when I'm going to be out of town.
Oh, no.
Seeing a band who I love playing.
Hootie and the Blowfish?
That's right.
I do love Hootie and the Blowfish.
Yeah, I mean, don't rip Hootie. There's nothing wrong with that.
I love Hootie.
Yeah, it's great. But I don't think they play live anymore. They are from South Carolina, though. They went to the University of South Carolina. They're super big. No, I mean, I was
like Darius Rucker, who's now a country star. It's basically like hearing Hootie.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah.
And you were at the Grand Ole Opry, too.
He didn't end up going, but I didn't realize he was supposed to be there. I didn't realize it was my first time seeing a country show at the Grand Ole Opry. I've been to the Grand Ole Opry before, but for other things. I didn't realize, I kind of equate going to the Grand Ole Opry as like getting a pack of baseball cards where you sort of open it and you kind of are flipping through and you don't really know everybody. And then all of a sudden you get like a King Griffey Jr. So, you know, we sat down and didn't know who was going to be performing. And it was like a couple of like up and comers, like all very talented. Like if you're on the stage of Grand Ole Opry, obviously you're good at what you do. Sure. So very talented. Yeah, yeah. So a couple of people you don't know. And then all of a sudden like Carrie Underwood walks out for like four songs. Okay. And she sings four songs and then goes back. And then a couple of people come out that like you don't know. And then like Trace Adkins comes out and sings, you know, a couple like it was really cool. Like you didn't really know. It was
four
fun.
Of her songs or
yeah, four of her like songs.
Country staples.
Four of her songs.
OK, gotcha.
It was cool, but I didn't realize that it was kind of like when I always thought it like Grand Ole Opry was like one person comes out and it's their stage for the night. But it's a pretty eclectic mix. I know this is not on the schedule of things to talk about, but I thought that was very interesting.
I do kind of love hearing about the exploits of the Roblon guys when they head out into the field, because Jake has some cool stuff as well too.
I sent the boys a picture of, because I was doing some interviews with the Opry over the weekend, and I was hoping that you guys would focus on the fact that like my boots were in the frame.
I did admire your boots.
No
boots,
or as they're referred to, shit kickers.
Yes,
that's what they're referred to.
Dave, you've heard that expression.
I've heard that expression, but I don't think a man who lives in the third biggest city in the country has shit kickers on his feet.
Were purchased when I live in Texas.
Okay, all right, okay.
That makes a lot of sense.
They haven't kicked shit in a long time.
I was going to say.
It's been a long time since they kicked shit.
A lot of pavement where you're walking with
us. All right, there's a couple movies that are opening this week. Two of them that we haven't yet seen, but a few of them we can get to talk about. And these first two are ones that I almost feel deserve a lot more attention, and it's a little bit sad that we haven't had a chance to see him. One is a George Miller film called 3,000 Years of Longing that I want to say was at Cannes. Mm-hmm. Is that where it started to screen? And I thought got pretty good reviews, but there was no opportunity to screen it here in Charlotte. They didn't have one in Chicago, I'm going to guess.
No, I don't remember there being. It's not to say that there wasn't, but
yeah. This is Tilda Swinton and Idris Elba.
Yeah, which is weird because Idris made the rounds for Beast, but didn't seem to really be doing much for this film.
Yeah, and I don't really know anything about it, to be honest with you, because I didn't read a lot about it when it was at Cannes because I just wanted to see it, and I didn't want to get too lost into the storyline. But now it's coming, so it'll be available in theaters if you guys want to check it out.
From the director of Babe, Pig in the City.
Yes, and also my favorite.
That's his favorite credit.
Mad Max Fury Road.
I seriously think that like it would have been really funny if for Mad Max Fury Road, if they had said like from the director of Babe, picking this, just totally went with it. And I think it would have been fantastic.
They put that on the black and chrome edition.
Wait, do they really?
No, I figured
that would be really cool. That'd be fantastic.
When we were at CinemaCon in Vegas earlier this year, Lionsgate showed a trailer or like a behind the scenes sort of putting together of this Sylvester Stallone movie called Samaritan. And I thought it looked pretty badass. And it is now coming to Prime Video. So I'm not quite sure what happened there. But it is a superhero movie of sorts starring Sylvester Stallone. He is like a retired superhero who no longer fights for whatever reason. And because a lot of the superheroes have stopped fighting crime, it's a hellscape sort of, you know, future apocalypse type thing. And he gets discovered by, I think, a little boy who like recognizes him from his past exploits and then tries to lure him back into fighting. But it looks like Stallone is getting a John Wick type franchise. Mm-hmm. But he's got superpowers, and I thought it looked really interesting and intriguing. And so I was looking forward to getting a chance to check it out before it came out. And I even pushed to get the director on the show, but instead, Samaritan's going to Prime Video. So check it out when it lands on Friday and see what happened there. John Boyega is in a film called Breaking that Jake got a chance to see. So, Jakey, what do people need to know about it?
It's a great performance by Boyega. So basically, it is a true story of a veteran who, when he returns home from the war, deals with PTSD and he deals with mental illness. And really just is trying to scrape by and survive. He meets a woman and they have a daughter. And he's really trying to work with the VA to get the benefits that he is due. Mm-hmm. He's not asking for much. He's basically asking for the couple of hundred bucks a month that is owed to him. But he finds himself in a situation where he's not getting the benefits that he's due, and he finds himself on the hard side of life, and he tries to reason with the people who, with the VA and with the government, to kind of give him what he's owed, because he's got a daughter and he's got a wife, and they humiliate him. They throw him out. At one point, they handcuff him and throw him out. I mean, this is a man who like served his country. And at the VA, they're throwing him out onto, quite literally throwing him out onto the street. Mm-hmm. So he takes it upon himself to walk into a Wells Fargo bank, and very politely, that's kind of the interesting thing about this man, and Brian very politely tells the bank tellers, "I have a bomb." He mm-hmm. gives a sign that I have a bomb. Get everyone out. Two of you stay. And call the news stations, and we're going to get me the $900 that I'm owed. Oh, he's wow. not asking for $1 million. He's not asking for a helicopter to take him to the Caymans. He's asking for the money that he's owed for being a veteran of this country. Right. Oh. It is a true story, a really powerful story. The ending, without getting into it, will just make you kind of question the system and how all of this works and how we're treating our veterans. But it's really an incredible opportunity for John Boyega to show what I think, if you've seen him outside of Star Wars, you've known for a while, that he's a truly tremendous actor. I mean, from yeah. Attack the Block and Detroit, I mean, I think he's really, really an amazing actor who has much more to show than I feel like. I mean, I liked him in Star Wars, but I really feel like after Force Awakens, Finn was kind of put to the side, and he wasn't given the opportunity that he deserved to show yeah. just what he could have done with that character. So I'm glad that he's taking roles like this that maybe aren't necessarily big splashy. I know he did Pacific Rim, but like maybe these aren't the big splashy blockbusters, but like he's taking roles that say, hey, like I'm a great actor, and if you give me the right material, this is what I can do with it. It's worth seeing for his performance. Even though this is a true story and the film I'm going to compare it to is not, kind of reminds me of John Q in a way. If you remember that Denzel film from about 20 years ago, mm-hmm. just sort of someone that's like doing a bad thing. I'm not saying it's a good thing to go in and like hold up a bank and like have hostages, but like where you sort of go, hey man, I get it. Mm-hmm. So a strong film. I don't necessarily think it's going to be an awards contender or anything, but really just a tremendous performance by Boyega. And if you get a chance to read the article that it's based on, the article goes much deeper into so many of the elements that the movie just doesn't have time to go into. And that's, I would recommend watching the film first and then doing a little bit of research on who this guy was and going into it. Cause the article that it's based on is really a fascinating read. Is it
like a magazine profile or?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. All right. So that's called Breaking and stars John Boyega and can be found in theaters this week. Let's take a quick ad break before we continue on with the new Kevin Hart and Mark Wahlberg film and then the movie The Invitation, which we discussed earlier in the show. And we are back. Okay, so Netflix has a movie that's coming out called Me Time, and it stars Kevin Hart and Mark Wahlberg. And it is not good. Oh, no. I don't know how else to tell you this.
I mean, I've seen the trailer. It doesn't look astounding.
Yeah, it feels like, and maybe this is unfair, but you know, Netflix is now putting out a lot of content, and this felt to me, it got a lot of, I'm going to give it a lot of criticisms that something like Red Notice seemed to get, which I didn't think was fair for Red Notice. I didn't necessarily see it, but that it was like
Red Notice.
Cheap and green screeny, like and it's just like now it is like an algorithm, you know, like
yeah,
these two stars get put together in this wacky situation. And
I have not seen the movie, but based on the trailer, I was gonna say it looks like they found a few weeks where Mark Wahlberg and Kevin Hart weren't busy, and yeah. they parked them outside of a studio. And they just did several scenes and tried to make each other laugh.
That's pretty much what it
is. That's what I got from the trailer.
I mean, even like so to describe it, it's like Kevin Hart and Mark Wahlberg were best friends, and they would get together specifically for Mark Wahlberg's birthday and do some like blowout celebration stunt type thing. But Kevin Hart eventually got married to Regina King's character and had a family and became like a suburbanite type stay at home dad, whereas Mark Wahlberg kept going on and doing his things, and they grew apart. And then for one weekend, Regina King finally comes up with an excuse to say, like, hey, I'm going to take the kids. You should just have some time at home and do your own thing. And it pairs Kevin Hart up with Mark Wahlberg for them to go out on these adventures. But it opens right off the bat with like a throwback to them where Mark Wahlberg is celebrating his 29th birthday. Does not look like he's celebrating his 29th birthday in the least bit at all, because he's 40.
Netflix dip into the Irishman budget.
Yeah, the Irishman money.
No, not only that, because they're supposed to be doing this like a cliff diving type thing where they're wearing those suits that if you spread your arms out, they turn into parachutes. Yeah. They are nowhere near a cliff. Yeah. Nowhere near. They're not outdoors from the get go. And so, yeah, it just, I don't know. It looked cheap and it was never really funny. And it was, you know, everything seemed kind of forced. And I don't know. Look, this just feels like, again, so that Netflix has an opportunity, you know, on one of their investor days to be like, look at all the stars that we're putting together. But then they actually have to come up with a project to put them into. And, you know, I don't think it's great because both of those guys can be really, really funny in projects. And especially, you know, if you pair them up with other people, whether it's Wahlberg with like Will Ferrell or Kevin Hart does a lot of stuff with The Rock. And it's Wahlberg. Not that the two of them are bad together. They just, the material is atrocious. And so.
Do you think that the actors these days would be more selective of the quality of their work if it was going to theaters?
Yes.
Like 100%. I think they would look, you know, I have not seen this film, but based on how you're describing it, they would probably look at this script and go, oh, it's not. Because when a movie bombs or doesn't do well, it kind of lingers over an actor's career, at least until like their next hit. As opposed to if they just put a movie out on streaming and whether it does well or not, like people see it, they talk about it, and then they move on to the next. It just doesn't leave the stench on their career like a theatrical bomb does. And so I feel like that's why so many of these big actors are willing to do lesser quality films if they're getting paid, because it just doesn't anchor down their career like a theatrical disappointment does.
And to circle back, Sean, to you mentioned Red Notice. Red Notice had a good story. It sounds like this doesn't have a good story. Like
it doesn't. No. Yeah. I mean, it just keeps making up stuff as it goes. But you know what? To go to Jake's point, it used to be that like comedians specifically would almost talk about like they'd get hell from their audience if they had to get a babysitter and go out to the theater, you know, to go see your new movie. And the last two that you gave them stunk, you know. Then they'd hold it against you and you'd worry that you're not going to bring your audience back. But if you're just on streaming and the people can watch 15 or 20 minutes and see if it works or not, bounce to the next thing.
And if Netflix only gauges success by whether or not you watched 120 seconds of their movie, you know, that's
for real.
Isn't it like how many people watched 2 minutes of the movie is how they determine.
Well, and they don't even disclose the numbers like that. Yeah. They won't even tell Kevin Hart and Mark Wahlberg if their movie did well. Like they just don't tell anybody.
Wow. So
I always go back to that Michael Caine Jaws 4 quote where he's like, I've never seen Jaws 4, but I saw the house that it built.
Yeah.
Yes. Although, you know, how much more money do Mark Wahlberg and Kevin Hart need?
Is that just going to be because I like Mark Wahlberg and Kevin Hart, but is that just going to be their bit for the rest of their career? Like buddy movies where Mark plays like the tougher part and buddy movies where, you know, Kevin Hart kind of plays the guy that gets made fun of, like he's paired with a tougher guy. Like that seems like that's the role they're slowly slipping into.
Kevin's been doing that for a long time now at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ride Along and Central Intelligence and all those types
Jumanji
of films.
That's
sort of his thing. At least Wahlberg at this one at least is not playing the stoic, you know, police officer type.
Yeah.
About. He's got a secret that I can't give away. That's part of the script, but he's more of an upbeat sort of party guy, which is fun to sort of watch him dig into that. So
that's cool,
but not enough for you to spend time watching it. Jake, tell us about The Invitation.
It feels like an August horror film. Film or like a January horror film. A young woman who doesn't really know much about her family finds that she has this connection with this upper class family in England, and they happen to be hosting a wedding for non-related family members. It's important to say. Yeah. And they say, hey, since you're this new family and we're all excited that like we have found you and that you're part of the family, come to this wedding. Come, you know. So she flies across the pond and goes to this very upper class wedding, which again is emphasized that that her family is hosting it, but the family that's, or the person that's been getting married, like they're not related, I guess is the point. Is that so? Because she falls in love with someone at the wedding, but it's important to emphasize that the person she falls for, she's not related to. They do a very good job of emphasizing that.
Yes.
But then it turns out that there is a dark, sinister reason that she has been invited there. And it turns into, I think it's safe to say, without it being a spoiler because it's in the trailer, it turns into a vampire film.
Okay.
And then from there, everything was, I don't know. This is the least sexy kind of review to do because like, I didn't think it was bad. I love the horror genre. So like at worst, I thought it was, I mean, it's fine. It's you know, it's exclusively in theaters. I can't honestly, I guess the bad part of this review is that I can't say that it's worth paying to go see in theaters. Mm-hmm. It really feels like the kind of horror film that they drop in a January or an August kind of period of the month.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfectly fine. Natalie Emanuel from Game of Thrones plays the lead. It's, you know, it kind of feels like a lesser vampire twist on Ready or Not. Nowhere near as good or as sharp as, you know, as that kind of film. You know, it's again, it's unsexy, but it's fine. It's not particularly scary, but I was intrigued enough to like at least get through it.
Oh, I didn't think it was scary at all. And
no,
in fact,
it's not.
I thought there was like it's a little bit more romantic. It leans into like a romanticism, like it almost has
gothic
one of those
romance,
like,
they would call it.
Yeah. It leans heavily into that because she falls for, you know, one of the people who are at the wedding. And then it kind of loses itself throughout the course of the second act of whether their relationship is going to come together sort of thing. I thought the movie spent a lot of time on that. What bothered me the most about The Invitation is that the central premise, when it's stated in the movie, you as an audience member will say, no, because she gets invited to a wedding, you know, for strangers that she's never met before in her entire life. And it's like a million red flags go up. And I can't give a movie a pass because they write a few lines of dialogue into it where another character goes, hey, you shouldn't go on that trip, you know, and or be really careful when you're over there. Make sure you're texting me constantly. It's like, yeah, I get that. That's fine. You're a little bit covering your bases. But for the most part, the movie should have stopped after 5 minutes, you know, where she should have been like, hey, come to this wedding. And the girl, if she had any sense, would have been like, no, I'm not going to go to that. I have no idea who you people are. So but I'm with you. You know, I didn't hate it in the least bit. I thought it was perfectly fine. You're right in the fact that that vampire twist should not have been in the marketing.
Yeah,
it would have been great if they got people into the theaters not suspecting where it was supposed to go.
Yeah.
But I even thought it telegraphed all of that pretty early on.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I mean, without getting to spoilers, I cannot praise the trailer for Barbarian enough, and that you can watch the trailer for Barbarian 10 times. And I guarantee you won't have any idea what that movie is about. And they could have done something similar with The Invitation. But instead, there's literally like, I think the I in Invitation in the logo is a steak.
Okay. So they're telling you exactly what you're getting into.
Yeah. You know, so they had a chance. But then again, to me, better marketing doesn't make the movie any better. Like, you still would have been.
What that rings to me, I haven't seen the movie and I don't work at a studio. To me, that sounds like they probably wanted to not reveal that. And then they cut the movie together. And it was just a meh movie. And they were like, we can't, the only way we're going to get people is if we
tell them
put in
the
trailer
movie.
That it's a vampire movie. And we just try to get people who are interested in watching vampire movies. Yeah. Because this movie's meh.
Yeah. I mean, then again, I mean, I want to say I've seen the trailer for From Dusk Till Dawn and it reveals that it's a vampire movie. But like at this point, that movie's old enough now. I'm pretty sure it does. At this point, it's old. It's an old enough movie that it's possible to come across people who haven't seen it and also are like so far removed from pop culture they haven't seen it. So that's a movie that as we've talked about, if you can show that to people who have no idea that it's a vampire movie, and when it turns, it's always such a great moment to watch people's reaction to that.
All right, let's shift to our blend game this week, which is hashtag music biopic blend. And Gabe, why did we choose this topic? Was there a reason?
Elvis? It's a giveaway, baby.
Oh, nice. See, what a good transition.
So I'll just do the giveaway pitch now. If you're listening to this Friday morning, I don't pick these until around noon Central Time. Feel free to write in. Hashtag music biopic blend. And we have five codes to give away triple pack of music biopic movies from the lovely folks at Movies Anywhere. So make sure you have access to Movies Anywhere when I reach out. And that includes Straight Outta Compton, unrated, Elvis, and Summer of Soul, our triple pack. Which Summer of Soul, not necessarily like a fictional biopic, but a wonderful documentary, underrated, and overshadowed Oscar this winning. Year's. Yes, whose Oscar was overshadowed by obvious.
Yeah, I would say that's reasons. I will always feel bad for Questlove.
So that maybe that's the movie this week that we stretch into the biopic, you know, category.
That'll be in 10 or 15 years. That will be a great trivia question at trivia night at a bar. Like, what is the Oscar that Chris Rock was giving out when he got slapped?
Oh, yeah.
That'll be a great trivia question.
Oh, yeah. I bet that's
because that's one of those things that like. We remember that, but would, you know, an average person.
Oh,
well,
no.
That's my point. It's overshadowed it. Yeah. People don't know. Yeah,
absolutely. Well, Gabe, why don't you just keep going? Hold the baton and give us your pick for hashtag music biopic blend.
So not to deflate this, music biopics are not my particular cup of tea. I enjoy them when I've enjoyed the ones that I've watched, but it's rarely do I feel excited to sit down and watch one. Like it's like,
well, I feel like they follow a formula. Mm-hmm. You know?
That's the big issue.
They're like Walk Hard makes fun of.
Yeah.
Yes. Very much so.
That's sort of the issue. I did really enjoy Elvis because I didn't know anything really about Elvis other than some of the controversy around his music and a little bit of this and that because he's Elvis. So it was cool to see, you know, more in depth. A certain angle of his story was cool. I mean, I thought that movie, regardless of who it was about and what happens in it, I thought the way that it was made, it was like I did not expect it to be as exhilarating and much of a journal rush. My pick is not Elvis, though. My pick is Walk the Line. For me, I think it's a great movie. I haven't seen it in a while, so maybe worth a rewatch. But it's one of those, you know, again, this is favorite. It's one of those special movies for me where Johnny Cash was one of my grandfather's like favorite musicians, was a big thing in our household. And that movie came out like not too long after my grandfather passed. And so it was just kind of like this serendipitous moment of getting to sort of remember him and experience someone that he loved, someone that he is sort of like an icon and a legend to him, let alone the amazing performances and the incredible story and the way that comes together. Obviously, Walk Hard undercuts that movie in a way because it's so funny by just kind of retelling that story, you know. But for me, like I said, in a genre that I don't necessarily have a ton of experience with, that I have a ton of movies that I love in, for me, that one has that special little touch of why I always appreciate it.
And James Mangold, you know, who people didn't really recognize yet, was such a talented filmmaker. Yeah. I think surprised a lot of people.
They said, somebody give this guy the Wolverine.
Yes, they did. Took it and ran with it.
Yeah. Someone give this guy Indiana Jones.
Oh. Walk the Line was the movie that I saw. It was the first movie I saw at the Toronto Film Festival. On my very first trip up there, I did do that junket.
Oh, yep. What a junket. Were they paired or were they separate?
Separate. They were separate. And I didn't get Mangold. I got Reese Witherspoon and I got Joaquin. And when I went to I was up in Toronto to do the junket and I went to Fox's suite and they sent me to a screening room because we were seeing it up there. And I went in and the only other person who was in the screening room with me was Roger Ebert, which was very, very cool. Yeah, it was my first trip to Toronto and I was so geeked to be up there. And then I walked into a screening room and Roger Ebert was there.
Did you talk to him?
No. And I just thought like, this is how things roll at the Toronto
International. John walked in and said, you son of a bitch, how you doing?
He's an empty theater. He sits right next to him. and then whenever he starts singing the Walk the Line song, he leans over to Roger and goes, it's Walk the Line.
That's the name of the name of the movie.
This is what it's based on. That's why they called it this. I'm going with The Doors.
Nice.
Oliver Stone's film about Jim Morrison. And for this reason, well, for a couple of different reasons, obviously. Morrison and The Doors, when I was growing up, was one of those figures who was extremely fascinating because he died so young. He died at 27. There were conspiracies in a way that I think people believed a lot more back in the 80s, 90s kind of thing, that Morrison faked his own death or, you know, was still alive kind of thing. What's that?
So wasn't that like around that time? Because that what do they call that? Like the 26 club? I'm butchering
27. Yeah, it's a club.
It was him, yeah. Hendrix. It was a bunch of musicians, like young musicians who died at
27.
All
died. Janis Joplin.
Buddy, yeah. Buddy Holly. I think Buddy Holly might have died at 27. Which is, sort of, you know,
that, yeah.
When I was a teenager, Morrison seemed really old, you know,
yeah, right, because, right.
But you know, 27 is ridiculous. And, right around the time that the Doors came out, that the movie came out, is when I started to pay attention to, filmmakers and the fact that, you know, oh, certain people direct movies, differently, and they turn out to be like these sort of epic stagings, and, you know, and that you can find a filmmaker or a director who's putting more love into a craft, and these movies are going to stand out for it. And it was because of scenes where, you know, in Miami, Morrison is getting arrested on the stage, you know, for lewd gestures and stuff. And the crowd is going nuts, and Stone stages it that way. And I was like, oh God, this is really like, I'm there. You know, it's like they plunged you into it because, hey, breaking news, Oliver Stone is a really talented filmmaker. But in addition to that, it was, Val Kilmer, you know, being so captivating in this mysterious character. And I loved the Doors' music at that time. And so to get insight into, because like Gabe was sort of saying, these musical biopics quite often seem really staid. And, you know, they focus on somebody who is so old or out of your time period. And I felt like Morrison was not that far removed. So to get an insight and a story that dove into the inside of how he came up in Los Angeles and on the Sunset Strip and they dove into his stage fright, you know, and being afraid to sort of turn around and sing to the people and then just sort of taking off from there like a rocket was a great, great story. And so I can remember it was also around the time when I started dragging my friends to the movies with me because I would go see. That's when I started to get into the point where I was like, I'm just going to go see everything that comes out now. And it was, I was in high school. And so I remember that's when my friends started to realize like, oh, if we're hanging out with you, then it means we got to go see some stuff that we never would go see anyway. Like I was getting my friends excited about going to see a new Oliver Stone film or something like that. And that holds a special place. But I rewatched The Doors recently to see if it holds up, thinking that it would be sort of dated but it's still tremendous, and Val Kilmer is still outstanding in it. Meg Ryan also really, really good.
What casting?
Yeah, the casting was great, and of course with Val being in Top Gun Maverick, he's still doing it to this day. But I'm going with the Doors. I thought that was great.
That's one of those castings where every once in a while you'll see like the meme or the post. Someone will post the pictures that they shot of Val side by side with the actual photos, mm-hmm. and seeing just how it's like, oh wow, that's kind of surreal. Yeah, how similar he looks.
He did great. So, Jakey, take us home.
The one I have chosen, I actually checked in with Gabe just to make sure that it was allowed. I picked 8 Mile because, I mean, technically not an Eminem biopic, but it's about as autobiographical as I think you're ever going to get with his work. What I kind of loved about 8 Mile, for me, the reason it kind of is separated from all other music biopics is that it never really gets into like the wild and crazy success part of his career. And that's where a lot of biopics tend to lose me. Like I love kind of like the origin story, but once it gets into like the glitz and glamour and like the number one hits and like, where kind of like, that's to me where most biopics kind of all end up being the same.
Yeah. This is how success changed them.
Yes. This is how like that. And what I loved about 8 Mile particularly is the ending, which is that he works his way up to this epic rap battle, wins, and what happens? He walks away down the aisle or down the alleyway, and he has to go back to work at the auto factory. That's his success story, is that like he did it and he's got to go back to work. Right. I loved kind of like that raw grittiness, like showing the trailer park that he grew up in and like the stuff with his stepdad, with Michael Shannon, and you know, everything with Brittany Murphy. It just felt very honest. And oftentimes, you know, I've spoken extensively about how on this show about how I do not like when people are involved in the telling of their own story when it comes to biopics. But if someone is willing to just be honest, I feel like that can come through in a really powerful way. I felt it came through with Rocketman. I felt like Elton John was very honest in the telling of who he was. And I felt like Eminem was very honest and sort of this, I don't want to say a fictional autobiography. I think it's very much his story. But it's
rare too. It's that he's playing.
Yeah. And he's playing himself. And yeah, it doesn't seem like a bit. Like it just seems very, they're playing the real people, you know, like what was it? What was it like 1517 to Paris? The Clint Eastwood movie where like the guys are playing the real guys.
Yeah, which was just you mean these people who can't act are not acting in this movie.
Yeah. but this just felt very like it was, I think it was his first like real, like true big acting performance. And of course, like the Lose Yourself song is legendary by this point. I love that movie. Yeah, Curtis Hanson did just a beautiful job directing it.
Dude, you're reminding me how much I miss having a new Curtis Hanson movie to look forward to. Right.
Right.
He was such a great director.
Incredible.
And that's a terrific pick. All right. Let's throw it to Kevin McCarthy, who couldn't join us this week, but is going to weigh in with his pick for hashtag music biopic blend. Kev.
Hey, guys, this is actually an interestingly fitting blend game this week. I'm here in Nashville, Tennessee, for the Academy of Country Music Honors. So that's why I wasn't on the show this week. But I had a chance to like talk to a ton of the people that are in the industry, Chris Stapleton, Shania Twain. So the music aspect of it's interesting because I was at a show last night at the Ryman Auditorium, which is a historic auditorium here in Nashville, one of the most historic venues in the world. So perfect time to do music biopic blend. I'm going to cheat a little bit, though, because I want to talk about a couple of them, and I'm going to keep this quick. But I love music biopics. I think it's one of my favorite things to watch in cinema. I absolutely love the way I love learning about people's lives in cinema and kind of the way like a 2.5 hour story can encapsulate. And I get it because like, you know, there's a interesting thing about biopics that follow a similar pattern, like, you know, the rise and the fall or of somebody. And there's a lot of them, but I wanted to highlight a couple of them. Straight Outta Compton, which I think is the first one that came to my mind, because I was just floored by that film. The performances, the just learning the history, and just Corey Hawkins as Dr. Dre and Cube's son playing Cube. I mean, what a beautiful full circle thing to have O'Shea Jackson Jr. playing his father. I mean, it's such a cool thing, and he did it so well. And that was F. Gary Gray, and I love that film because it made me learn a lot about the music and the story and Eazy-E, and there was just so much in that film that I love, and I thought it was just beautifully done. It was different. It felt different than a normal biopic. It just felt raw and real. I loved it. Also want to shout out Walk the Line. Again, these are all movies that made me appreciate the music of the artist a lot more. I appreciate Johnny Cash more because of what Joaquin Phoenix did with that performance as Johnny Cash. And what's really even weirder is I'm in Nashville right now, and at the Ryman Auditorium, where I was last night for the show, is where Johnny Cash met June Carter, who's played by Reese Witherspoon in the movie. So that's another big one for me. Obviously, you know, and this is a weird one. 8 Mile is one of my favorite biopics ever in terms of music. Huge Eminem fan. But that movie was so cool. And Curtis Hanson directed that. And I just love the battle rap scenes. I loved the songs that were for it. It was just the performances, learning about where he came from. So those are like the three that I really wanted to highlight. I mean, there's so many other ones. And I know we talk on the show a lot about Rocket Man versus Bohemian Rhapsody. I'm more of a Bohemian Rhapsody fan in terms of the film. But overall, those are the three I want to say. So I know I'm cheating a bit by giving a few of them, but just the nature of where I am right now in terms of music and what it means, I wanted to highlight a couple of them. So I miss you guys and I love you guys, and be back next week. And we have a huge If It Happens next week. So excited about that. See you guys.
As for audience picks, we want to thank you guys for playing along. We have Kelly Rea, who went with Purple Rain. Michael Breen said Amadeus. Joe Saffer, Kimberly Sue, Johnny, and many, many others joined Gabe with Walk the Line. Harry Case went with Rocket Man. Paul Marsh said Ray. Lowen M said Tick Tick. Oh, Tick Tick Boom. God, why didn't I pick that? I love Tick Tick Boom. Yeah. Oh my God, I totally forgot about it. And then Rusty said Elvis. The other one I wanted to throw in just for good measure is Love and Mercy. If people didn't see Love and Mercy recently.
Yeah, of course.
Paul Dano and John Cusack playing Brian Wilson at different stages of his life is fantastic.
Not to like name drop, but I did this show so weird that we're doing this as a blend game. And based on an interview, I just interviewed Garth Brooks a few days ago and talked to him about the recent string of, because if you don't know, Garth Brooks is my favorite music artist of all time, and spoke with him about the recent string of music biopics. And he told me that his favorite is Ray, which I thought was interesting. Told me he did not like, he didn't say didn't like, but that he'd like to see a different Elvis movie because he felt that Baz Luhrmann's was too much about Colonel Tom Parker. He said that it was, he said it was a little too much. He wanted more Elvis, which I actually liked that it was the old Tom Parker thing.
It gave it its own thing.
So that's Garth Brooks's pick.
Who does Garth want to play him in a musical biopic?
Michael B. Jordan. And I said like I was like, yeah, because like him and Creed, it's like looking in a mirror. He's like, yeah, with the six pack and everything. It's
to be fair, anyone should ask Michael B. Jordan to play that.
That's
in
fair.
Movie.
I would ask him
too. I had the six pack. I swear to God, I had the six pack the whole time.
I just picture, you know, remember that shot of him in Creed where he's like banging on his chest and like the muscles are like. Yeah, I just picture like whenever they do the gay biopic, it's gonna be like him telling us to rap and like banging his chest like the muscles are
absolutely shredded.
Yeah.
All right. Next week, we're gonna be playing hashtag Regina Hall blend. So go to Twitter using hashtag Regina Hall blend, or let us know your pick via email at realblend@cinemablend.com. And as always mentioned, using that email is where you can leave us a review, or of course you can go to Apple Podcasts, or you can go to Spotify, all these different places where you can leave us to reviews. And this week's review comes from Tim Dammer, who says 5 stars. Movie theater parking lot. Okay, Real Blend feels like conversations, sometimes arguments, I have with friends in the movie theater parking lot after a showing. Keep up the good work. Well, that's a terrific way to sort of capture what we're going for here. So thank you, Tim. We appreciate you sending that review in. Our next premium episode is going to be a mailbag, as mentioned. Mailbag. If you guys ever want questions that we can answer for you, whether it be about our jobs or the show or life in general, we're happy to address them during the mailbag. And become a premium subscriber, go to the description here where the show is listed, and it'll tell you how you can sign up for additional fun Real Blend type stuff. If you want to follow us during the week, we are on social media at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, at Sean_O'Connell, at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We'll be back next week. We have a couple of really fun things cooking, as always. So until then, The Fablemans.
The Batmans.
The Batmans.
Two.